Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Living free.
Welcome to the Living Free Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 kHz on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. Hi, I'm Bill, and with my show co-host Zakia, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, traditional owners of the land from which 3CR transmits people-powered radio. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and acknowledge that this land was stolen and that sovereignty was never ceded. Each week on the Living Free Show, we showcase one of the many programs that assist in recovery from drugs, alcohol, gambling and food addictions. Our guests share their recovery story and highlight that shared experience saves lives. Also, please note that Living Free Show may involve discussion of topics such as suicide, mental illness, self-harm and family violence. Please consider your well-being and that of others around you while listening. My guest today is a recovering drug addict, and I'd like to welcome Tom to the show. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Great that you could come on the show, and thanks for letting me know you're available.
That's fine. Pleasure to be here.
Good. Now, Tom, as you know, we usually start the show by talking about growing up and family and the things that influenced you to take the path you took. So do you want to talk a bit about, you know, your early life and influences?
Yeah, I can, of course. It was a fairly middle-class family. On the outside, it seemed like everything was fairly peachy. But, you know, growing up, there was also a degree of dysfunction in the family. I remember when I was a kid, there were lots of fights between my parents. They didn't really bring the best out in each other. And I would often, when the arguments broke out between them, I would leave the house and go to the park. And I remember being in the street and wondering why I wouldn't hear yelling from any of the other houses. So, yeah, but that being said, materialistically, we were given everything that we needed. You know, school fees were paid, and my father worked very hard. He would travel often for business, and mum was there to raise us kids, and she gave her all, you know. She showed a lot of interest. I believe her parents didn't really show much interest in her life growing up, so she made a pact to herself that she would show interest in us kids. While she wasn't the most tactile mother, she's quite scientific and analytical in her way, but she made up for that by showing a lot of interest in us growing up.
Yeah, well, it really helps having an interested parent, because one that's disassociated from you is very it's not much, I can tell you. Yeah. So did you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I have older sister, younger brother. So I'm the stereotypical middle child.
Okay.
And my older sister was, you know, she was great at sport, high achiever, great academically. And my father often fostered competition between us. I remember my sister got a fairly high ENSA score of 99.85, and my father often said to me, you know, you're smarter than your sister, you can beat your sister. And so the pressure was on to do really well, and I don't think I did too well under that pressure. I think in the end, things sort of came undone for me around year 11. But
yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah.
Okay. So how did you go at school? Did you fit in with your friends?
Yeah, I was quite social. Yep. I had a good circle of friends. I went to a private school for all of my primary school and for the year 7 and 8, and I was quite academic. I got a scholarship to that school and was offered a scholarship to another school that we turned down. But yeah, socially I'm quite a people person. I enjoy being around people. I flourish around social situations. That being said, you know, there's always a feeling like I was a square peg in a round hole. That's a common thing amongst, you know, people in recovery from addiction, and socially I was often seeing friends and things. That was not a problem. So
yeah. So when you say you felt square peg in a round hole, so was it anxiety or not fitting in or feeling different? What was the...
Looking back on it now, I think as a kid I had sort of sub-pathological, sort of sub-clinical levels of a mental illness that had yet to hit crisis point. So it sort of flew under the radar a bit. But, looking back, I had some depressive, sort of anxious depressive episodes when I was in year eight. I remember around the month of April, I often struggled around April. And around the month of April, I sort of started skipping a lot of class and got behind in my studies. I was under a lot of pressure. And I remember saying to some older students, I can't believe studying's this hard. And they were like, you're in year eight, you know, you shouldn't be struggling. Just wait till you get to year 10, year 11. So... You know, I was an eccentric kid as well. I was big into music and big into extracurricular stuff. I played a lot of music. You know, I liked to improvise on the piano. That was a big thing. And later in life, I'd sort of discover production of electronic music, and that still remains a big passion of mine. So, yeah.
Yeah, we'll hear a bit more about that later.
Okay.
Tom's brought in one of his songs, so we'll play that. So often, you know, kids around 12, 13, 14 feel different, you know, going through puberty, feeling not fitting in and stuff. But I think it's the sensitive ones where that strikes most. Mm. So what was it like for you around that time? You know, I think you said you were in year eight when you changed schools.
I remember I got into a selective entry high school and I changed schools. And the reason for that was I heard my parents fighting a lot about money, and I wanted, you know, I figured that going to a public high school would remove some of that pressure. So I switched schools and I embraced it. And I remember the first day of school, I'd already been quite curious about drugs, and I think that curiosity stemmed from a kind of desire to self-medicate. I remember got off at the train station and started following the more senior kids through the pathways to school, because we didn't, the early year nine students didn't know how to get there, and going through the back lanes, following the older students in every alcove of that high school. You'd see students in those school blazers of the school I went to, and they were all smoking bongs, and I just thought to myself that this school is going to be really good for me. So, yeah, I actually embraced the existing drug culture in that school at the time quite wholeheartedly after that.
Yeah. So did you feel that you fitted in? Did you feel more comfortable when you started using drugs?
Drugs sort of gave me something to identify with and a culture to identify with. It was quite misguided at the time, but, you know, I fell for this idea that drugs were quite cool, and it was a way to sort of put a label to the rebelliousness of youth that was starting to kick in. I remember... I asked some older students for some marijuana seeds because I wanted to grow my own plant. And at some point, one student, I believe, got busted with a bong in his blazer pocket, and he named every other student who he knew to the teachers who were involved in the drug culture, and my name was one of them. And there were actually drug busts at that school that hit the newspapers, and I remember my locker being searched, and then we all being led to this, it was like a castle, up this sort of turret, into a teacher's room where we all had to face forward and we couldn't talk to each other. And and while the teachers did their investigation into exactly how deep the drug culture went at that school at the time, which was quite deep, and a lot of people got detentions and suspensions, but I fortunately wasn't one of them because nothing got found. So.
Right, that was lucky. Yeah.
Yeah, quite lucky.
So, I guess getting back to your using, how did it progress?
Well, it started out with experimentation, and marijuana is the standard.
Yep.
Alcohol as well. I told myself I wouldn't get into alcohol because my father's a big drinker and I knew it caused a lot of issues in the family. So I gravitated more towards marijuana and I would smoke a joint every night. I'd do my, practice my music, do my study, and then before bed each night I'd smoke a joint. And that was mainly because I liked the way it made me feel the next day. The next day I'd feel a bit fogged over and my moods weren't so labile and up and down, and my emotions were a bit blunted from the marijuana hangover, and I enjoyed that feeling. It made me feel just the anxiety of adolescence it turned the dial down on my emotions somewhat, and that's what I enjoyed at the time, was that feeling the next day.
Yeah, it's probably a level of sensitivity more than anything, I guess, rather than actually dialing your emotions. It's but I think that if you're a sensitive kid, then you pick up on a lot of things that people say or do or don't say or don't do. A lot of things influence you that way. Yeah. So how did it affect your studies?
It started to affect my studies. I managed to juggle being an academic student and having a drug-using identity sort of on the sly pretty well up until year 11. But at the start of my VCE, I actually gave up all drugs because I wanted to succeed and there was a lot of pressure on me to do well. My father said, you can beat your sister, you're smarter than your sister. He was counting on me to excel in my VCE, and I actually gave up all drugs, but there's something about the pressure of VCE that I was under, and I might have smoked marijuana once in year 11, but it all came sort of undone around April, May of year 11 when I was 16, turning 17, and I had a psychosis, which was the first of quite a few in my sort of younger years. And I was taken to see a psychiatrist and put on antipsychotic medication, which was a real drag. It knocked me around a lot. And I actually took the rest of the year off to recover. And I just remember sort of being lost after that and deeply depressed. Because I went from being someone who the teachers and parents would say, you're quite academic, you can be whoever you want to be when you grow up, to having psychiatrists say, you can't really trust your own mind and perception, and my grasp on reality was questionable, and it was a big knock to my ego, really, so I, taking time off, I ended up getting a full-time job at Hungry Jack's flipping burgers, and I was a bit of a lost cause, and that's when the harder drugs came into the picture then.
Okay. So how did that start? What was the attraction to hit it harder?
Well, I think being deeply depressed at that time, recovering, when you're recovering from a psychosis, a period of depression often comes. It's like your brain has had a trauma and it needs to recover. So for about 6 months, I was deeply depressed. And I remember I went to a party with my school friends, and the day after we were in the city, to get, you know, a fried meal because we were all a bit hungover. And I saw on the ground at the corner of Flinders and Swanson Street, I saw an orange water balloon, and I picked it up and brought it to the cafe because I remember reading in The Age at the time that drug dealers kept drugs in these little water balloons, and definitely wasn't empty. I opened it up at the cafe and noticed there was a little bit of white powder in the foil inside the water balloon, and I got a bit excited, and I went home and I put it on the foil and I smoked it, and it wasn't arsenic. It showed to me that I really didn't care much about my life to take such a risk as to pick up drugs on the ground and to inhale the vapor from it. But I pretty well quickly identified that what I picked up was heroin, and it felt like God came down from the heavens and gave me a big warm hug, and I was a goner from that point. I was addicted from the first go. So yeah, that's pretty well how my drug use progressed from adolescent experimentation, which is really common, to embracing one of the harder drugs, and that addiction's been side by side with me until now, and I'm in my early 40s. So,
wow, yeah. Okay, well, listen, we'll talk more about it after the break, but we've got a break, and there's a song, and this one's called it's by Daniel J. Farthing. It's called Run Needy Run. And it's a powerful anthem supporting Ned Brockman's 100-mile challenge for homelessness awareness. It has a fundraising goal of $10 million for We Are Mobilise, a charity dedicated to addressing homelessness in Australia. So I hope you enjoy it.
So run, let it run, not just for fun. Don't you stop now, cause it isn't done. Boy from the country moving to the city, got a bit of a shock when it wasn't so pretty, and you know that they didn't ask for your pity, but no one would listen, yeah, no one would listen. Now you doubled down on your noble ambitions, you hit the dirt track and that's in ideal conditions, cause you know that there's someone going through hell, you've got to find like some cunt caught in bond, I swear. Let you run, let you run. Yeah, you run, and 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 you run. So run, let it run, not just for fun. Well, don't you stop now, cause it isn't done yet. Run, let it run, not just for fun. Well, don't you stop now, there's no finish gun. So run, let it run, not just for fun. Well, don't you stop now, cause it isn't done yet. Run, let it run, not just for fun. Well, don't you stop now, cause it isn't done. Show me one of the reasons, show me the reason, one of the reasons, show me the reason, one of the reasons, show me the reason, one of the reasons, show me. So run, let it run, not just for fun. Don't you stop now, cause it isn't done yet. Run, let it run, not just for fun. Don't you stop now, there's no finish line. So run, let it run, not just for fun. Don't you stop now, cause it isn't done. No, run, let it run, not just for fun. Don't you stop now, cause it isn't done. Let's go.
Get lost
in science.
Tune in to 3CR every week to hear
Beth,
Chris
and Stuart
discuss news and issues from the universe that is science.
Get informed and learn a bit more about the world around you. Lost in Science can be heard every Thursday at 8:30 in the morning and is repeated the following Tuesday at 6 a.m.
Word to the nerd. You can also download a podcast.
Go to the website at www.3cr.org.au and get lost in science.
Welcome back. This is the Living Free Show on 3CR, 855 kHz on your AM dial and 3CR on digital radio. If you'd like to listen to one of our many podcasts, you can find them on your preferred podcast platform or just Google 3CR Living Free and check out our website. You can also contact us via phone or email. Today we're talking with Tom about drug addiction and recovery and mental illness. So Tom, before the break you talked about taking heroin for the first time. So do you want to talk a little bit more about the after effects of that on you?
Yeah, sure, Bill. It wasn't long before my parents found out about, and I believe it was really foolish of me looking back, but one of the effects of heroin is it made me brutally honest to people about, because I thought it would give me this false sense of security that everything would be okay, and I actually told my parents shortly after, and it didn't go down well at all, really. And I have a memory of I would touch the bench and Mum would follow me around with bleach and then spray anything that I touched with bleach, and I was called names so really, and at this point my parents' marriage was disintegrating and they were separating, and I actually went to live with my father in a rental property in Richmond while my younger brother was doing his year 12. Mum wanted us both out of the house, so my father and I lived in Richmond, and as you may know, Richmond is quite close to the heroin epicenter of the country, really. I've lived in Sydney and Newcastle, and there's, you know, King's Cross and Cabramatta don't really come close to the way Richmond is at the moment. So, I went to my first rehab around in my late teens. I was dating a woman who worked in hospitality, and she was a big drinker, and I remember when I went to the rehab, they introduced us to these 12-step meetings called NA, and I identified a lot with what a lot of the speakers shared in those rooms, and there was a bit of pressure in the rehab for me to break up with my partner because her drug of choice was alcohol, whereas mine was heroin, and they believed that if I had any chance of success in with my recovery, I'd need to break off that relationship, and I did, which showed that I was quite willing to do what it took. But I found that the moment I got home from that rehab, just being in the old environment, and it didn't take long for me to return to my drug of choice. So yeah, over the years I've been to quite a few rehabs and probably countless outpatient detoxes, and I've found that I've had the most success with the longer rehabs, the kind of Odyssey House or Windana environments, the ones where you spend, you know, over a year in a therapeutic environment. They're the ones which put me in, give me a good running start, and I can do quite well in those environments.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I think just at a biological level, your brain needs a period of at least 90 days. I consider the 90-day milestone to be really significant because, you know, if you have private health cover, you might be able to get into a 28-day rehab, but it's just simply not long enough for any lasting change to be instilled. Sure, they teach you a lot of the theory about recovery, but in order to apply it, you just basically need a good minimum of 90 days, and if anything, at least 6 months of abstinence from that drug or any addictive drug to put you in good stead and to have a chance at long-lasting recovery.
Yeah. So Can you talk about how abstinence from illicit drugs goes with being on medication for a mental illness?
Yeah, I remember my first NA sponsor. I tried to be clear to him that I'd need to remain on my medication, and he used to say things like, oh, if you work the steps of NA, the 12 steps of NA, you probably won't need medication anymore. And I kind of believed him, you know, and thankfully he didn't remain my sponsor for too long though. And I found someone with a bit more of a mature, nuanced kind of perspective about recovery and you know, it can be a bit controversial because there's a lot of people in NA who abuse pills, who see, and there is a bit of a crossover between some of the medications and drugs of abuse. Like I think of, you know, people in prison often Seroquel is a bit of a commodity in those places. So, and Seroquel is often prescribed for people with psychotic illnesses. So yeah, there is a small crossover between psych meds and drugs of abuse. But yeah, these days NA is a lot more mature when it comes to people being on medication. Dual diagnosis which is co-occurring mental illness and addiction, which is what they call the label for that. And there's a much better perspective when it comes to dual diagnosis in the rooms, and sponsors tend to stay away from having opinions about medication, which is a step in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Because as you say, they're completely separate issues.
Mm.
That's and as we were sort of discussing earlier, that people like food addicts, you've got to eat. It's just about controlling the amount and keeping it within acceptable limits in real terms. So you came out of rehabs, you came out of detoxes. So how did things start going wrong when you come out? What's the usual pattern?
I'd say often it's depression. As I've grown older, my bipolar manifests more so in depression than mania. And I miss the manic episodes. I had a lot of manic episodes in my early 20s. But it's the nature of the progression of bipolar disorder that the mania, as you grow older, you tend to have more depressive symptoms and less manic symptoms. And I've noticed that, which is a shame because, you know, I'm quite productive when I'm manic. I'm expansive when I'm manic. I make new friends. I meet new partners. I often embark in new relationships. Mm-hmm. I do things like start writing a book. I start new business enterprises. You know, all that. Bipolar is kind of like the expansive parts of life are isolated to these periods of hypermania and mania, but and it can sound like a gift, but the depression's more than make up for that by being periods where you're very isolated, don't get out of bed for days or weeks at a time sometimes. You know, you forgo the adult responsibilities like work can be hard to handle, and there's a lot of brain fog and cognitive issues that come with depression as well. And for me, when I'm depressed, that's when my recovery from addiction's at risk, because, you know, there are, when a person's depressed with bipolar, there's often suicidal ideation comes into the picture, and it's very easy to rationalize, I can use drugs because my mind's going to a much darker place than just using drugs. So yep, at least if I use, I'll have 6 hours without this relentless onslaught of negative feelings. So yeah, that's when I'm at risk of using. And to this day, I find that I can't guarantee whether I'll stay clean or not come that time, but I'm getting better at it with each each year of my life and as I get more experience. And often it just comes from being uncomfortable and picking up the phone when I don't want to, and going out when I don't feel like it, and staying connected in those periods.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how what strategies you have, but that, you just explained them well. Yeah, okay. How does keeping a good relationship with your family help?
Yeah, I've managed to stay quite connected with my family. I think it's because it's thanks to, you know, going to rehabs and thanks to medication, is that my rock bottoms haven't gotten to the point where my family's, you know, put me in the too hard basket and cast me to the wolves. You know, I've managed to remain connected to my parents and my siblings. And having that good relationship has really, I think, has prevented me from, it's been a safety net from my addiction, you know, taking hold to the point where, you know, I've managed to be in my early 40s and not had a criminal record. And that's largely because when my addiction's gotten out of hand, I've pulled myself up because I've wanted to maintain my relationships with my friends and family. And often that means going into rehab before it gets too out of hand, which has both been good and bad, because in 12 steps they say, you know, your rock bottom can be what compels you to get clean. But for me, you know, I've seen a lot of people, I've been to a lot of funerals, I've been to a lot of people over the years who haven't made it from their addiction. And, you know, just the fact I'm still here, despite, you know, everything I've put my body and my life through, is indicative that, you know, I've managed to survive and yeah, maintain good ties in my life. So yeah.
Yep. That's good. Okay, thank you. We'll take another short break. This is a track, it's an anthem exploring the concept of justice and inescapable consequences of one's actions, but it's also a celebration of resilience and truth telling. And it's called Karma, featuring Uncle Kev Starkey, and it's by Bird of Paradise. I hope you enjoy.
Are you scared, baby? Well, you should be. Karma's calling for you.
Do you really know how to be sorry? Do you really know what that means? Weekly Radio.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, environmental sustainability, democracy and equality.
There is one newspaper that is independent of powerful interests, and that's Green Left Weekly.
It presents ideas mainstream media won't. It exposes the lies and distortions of the power brokers and helps us to better understand the world around us.
It's the leading source of local, national and international news, analysis and discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movements. Tune in every Friday morning at 8 a.m. on 3CR.
Welcome back. This is the Living Free Show on 3CR Digital Radio, live streaming on 3cr.org.au, and we're talking with Tom, and we're talking about recovery from drug addiction and mental illness. So, Tom, Zakia's got a question for you.
Tom, if you could tell us who influenced you the most.
It's a hard question, but thinking about it, probably my father. I still maintain a relationship with him, so I've got to be quite tactful. But you know, he loves a drink. He enjoys drinking with his sons. Growing up, I remember when I was smoking marijuana, he occasionally, if he'd had a bit too much to drink, he'd come into my room and ask me for some weed. And there were times I smoked it with him, but at the same time, there was a bit of a kind of push-pull, love-hate kind of relationship with him, because, you know, I think to a degree he had me pegged as the black sheep in the family for some time, and he was quite hands-on with his discipline toward me, while I often copped that, my sister and my brother didn't so much. So looking back, I think that heavily influenced who I turned out as an adult. So that being said, there's a lot of good features to my father as well, and that heavily influenced me too. He's very much a people person. He's got a wide circle of friends. I think I get a lot of my social nature from my father, but, you know, yeah, both good and bad. So, yeah.
Yep. Thanks, Zakir. Good question. So, Tom, do you want to talk a bit about your life now and, I guess, how you live your life and why you do it, why you live it that way?
Well, these days I don't do 12-step groups so much. I'm on medication-assisted treatment where I get, each month I go and get an injection and it blocks the effects of heroin. So, as long as I get that regularly, I can maintain an even keel in life. And, I've got my own little business where I fix people's computers and self-employment works quite well for me because, you know, I have periods where I really struggle owing to my mental illness and the flexibility of self-employment allows me to sort of work around those times and work to my own schedule. And my clients are quite understanding of that as well, and they still want to engage my services, so that's quite good. I've got a good circle of friends, some of them, you know, in a similar situation to me, some of them in the rooms of NA, other ones who, I have a good friend who's doing drug court at the moment, who's excelling in life. He's got 2 years abstinent from his drug of choice, and that all started with a trip to prison and then being put on drug court, and that he's actually doing really well from that experience. And one of the things about being in recovery is a lot of people do relapse, so, and I do stay in touch with the people that do relapse, so As long as I maintain good boundaries in my own life, I can manage that and still reach out to them when they struggle. Because I know one of the hardest things for me when I've relapsed is to see people turn their back on me. So I choose not to do that when I see people fall over.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good thing to do. One thing I wanted to ask you is about, I guess, alternate treatments and things you've had. So have you been on methadone?
Yeah, I have. Yeah. Methadone, it's good. It reduces your chance of overdose significantly. One of the good things about pharmacotherapy or medication-assisted treatment is that it reduces your chance of overdose by a minimum of 50%. And I think I'm still alive largely because of it. One of the negatives of methadone is that you have to pick it up regularly from a pharmacy, and it's got the nickname liquid handcuffs for a reason. You know, you makes it hard to travel. You need to do a lot of organization to you have to see your doctor, get a special script for fireceptone, and if you travel overseas, you have to get it cleared with the embassy and all sorts. And people often don't bother to go on holidays or travel when they're on methadone because of it. Whereas the treatment I'm on at the moment, it's just once a month. You go to the pharmacy and get an injection, and it keeps me level, and I can still go on holidays and travel, which is a lot more freeing than being on methadone. And that's why I opted for this form of treatment.
Yeah. Another one I was going to ask you about was doing geographicals. Have you done that before?
Yeah, I've been to Sydney twice. I went to a rehab called WHOS in Sydney, which is a boot camp, intense therapeutic community. I kind of have mixed feelings about therapeutic community as a model of rehab because they're quite intense and culty in their own way. But the first time I did WHOS, I actually went and lived in Newcastle, and I stayed clean for 2.5 years, and I did quite well. I surfed and studied at uni, and yeah, I have good memories of those periods. I find that geographicals, that is moving to another city or state or country to get away from your ill behavior in your home city, I find that they work to a degree. They work while the novelty of the new environment is still fresh. But when things start to get mundane and life starts to, when that novelty of a new place starts to wear thin, that's when you need to have something else in place, which is when NA or smart recovery or outpatient programs really come into the picture.
Yeah. So what about connections with family now? How's your relationship with your parents and siblings?
I think they're all right. They could be a lot worse. I've seen people whose families have disowned them, and as a result of that, they really threw themselves to the wolves and came to struggle a lot harder than I have. I think my mother attending Al-Anon has allowed her to be, to a degree, detached from my issues and not enabling of my issues, which has allowed her to remain in my life. Whereas if she didn't attend such groups, I might have been able to manipulate her to get money, like I've seen in some of my peers who've had addictions. You know, I know people who've managed to get their parents to score drugs for them, which is something that my family would never do for me.
Yeah.
I'm lucky in that I still have relationships with my family. So, yeah.
Yeah. So on a final note, I guess, do you want to talk about your music? We'll play a bit of it at the end of the show, but do you want to talk about your music and your interest in music?
Yeah, sure. As a kid, I played piano and I got lessons and clarinet, and extracurricular music activities were a big part of my life. I found when I played piano that rather than practicing what I was meant to practice, I'd end up improvising a lot. And to this day, I like to sit on a piano and just jam and improvise and play by ear. And as a teen, I embraced electronic music wholeheartedly, and I started writing my own. And to this day, it's become a bit of a hobby. And I used to play live dance music at bush parties like Earthcore and Rainbow Serpent Festival. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of my life through my 20s. But as I've grown older, the music I write is a bit more relaxed and more ambient.
Yep.
And so the song I've chosen for you to play now or coming up is more of an ambient piece that I thought would be a bit more radio friendly than my dance music bangers. So yeah.
Right. Okay. That's good. So is there anything else you'd like to talk about your condition that you want to share with people to, I guess, give them an insight into how you feel about your journey?
Yeah, I've noticed, because people like Kanye West talk about bipolar being their superpower and stuff, that there can be a bit of misinformation, or it's more of a curse than a blessing, I think. When I think about my life, how different it could have been if I didn't have bipolar, I think for one, 60% of people with bipolar end up with a significant drug or alcohol problem, which is a huge
Yep.
statistic. And I think one of the reasons for that is when you can't guarantee how you'll feel from one day to the next, drugs and alcohol are the only predictable thing. I take X drug, I'll feel Y. And that can be really alluring, you know, to a person who, you know, you could be on your honeymoon or the best holiday in the world and not want to get out of bed. So I think that's one of the reasons so many of us with bipolar end up with a substance abuse issue. Alcohol's definitely a big one, but yeah, I think that my life would have been a lot different if I didn't have the bipolar. And unfortunately, I come from a family where there is a fair few mental health issues. My brother's got schizophrenia. My older sister has had her share of mental health issues while she was at uni, and a mother who's on medication, and a father who arguably has a personality disorder. So we're definitely one of those little pods of sickness. I say that with the most compassion and care, but yeah, I think my life, If I didn't have bipolar, it would have panned out very differently. So yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. So you talked earlier about having a relationship. So do you crave to have a relationship again, or is that something you're sort of living with?
I've been looking back through my life. I've had a lot of relationships. And my addiction, if anything, has been the thing that's caused them to come undone. But I'm actually taking a bit of time off relationships at the moment to focus on myself. That's the advice of others. You know, I'm back in early days in recovery, and it's often said that you need to spend a good year or 2 years just focusing on your own issues. So I do miss it, but at the same time, this is probably the first time I've been single for a prolonged period, and I'm enjoying the independence as well. So
yeah,
Yeah.
That's good. So what about living conditions? Do you find it difficult finding places to live?
Not really. I've had a flat, my own flat, since about 2013, though. I moved out for a couple of years, and that flat's owned by extended family. I still pay rent, but at a reduced rate, so I'm really fortunate that my housing hasn't come undone. But living on your own I find I'm very much a people person, and you know, living on your own, you've got to remain vigilant, because you're only accountable to yourself. Whereas if I lived in a share house, you know, or a recovery house, it might, you know, you'd be accountable to your housemates and as well. So I have to remain vigilant and focused on my recovery because of that.
Yeah. Yeah. What else was I going to say? So I guess looking back, was there any particular aspect of your recovery or journey that you think, if you had have had it earlier, would have helped?
I was introduced to recovery fairly early. I think if I'd had it earlier.
Or is it the readiness more than the...
Yeah, the ready... Being... I think you have to experience a degree of pain in order to have a desire to change. And perhaps if I'd been introduced to NA before the... Or recovery in general before I embraced the harder drugs, that there was probably a window of time of about a year where that could have... You know, just having that social connection and understanding, because in addiction support groups, mental illness is probably more the norm than the exception these days in those groups, and there would have been a lot of understanding for what I went through. Whereas at that point of time when I gravitated towards the harder drugs, I genuinely felt like I was alone. I could go into the psychotic delusions that I was under at the time, but I genuinely felt like I was the only person in the world experiencing those issues at that time. So, yeah, if people, there'd been other people that I could have spoken to about what I was going through at that point in time, it might have arrested it before it got out of hand.
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Thank you. Righto. Well, if anybody would like to find out more information about drug addiction and recovery, one good place to head is Narcotics Anonymous. They're at navic.net.au, and you can call them on 1300 652 820. I'll put the other details of Smart Recovery and Al-Anon in the podcast. So that's about all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank Tom for sharing some more of his drug addiction and recovery story with us and talking about what helped him. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Bill. It's been a pleasure.
I hope you'll be able to join us again next week when we'll be talking with Derek about recovery from alcohol addiction and the help of Alcoholics Anonymous. Coming up next, we've got Balanwar, hosted by Uncle Talgum Choco Edwards. Join Uncle Choco in the spirit of Wah on a journey of belonging and movement through sing-alongs and yarns. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and stay tuned now for Kara's song, which is one of Tom's. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the song, Tom?
Yeah, I wrote it quite a number of years ago. It's an ambient piece. It's very relaxing, sort of maybe meditate, get into a yoga position, and yeah, enjoy.
Okay, thank you very much. So enjoy.
woman in a pair of goggles? Do you think you got what it takes? Well, do you? All right, you're in. Welcome aboard.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.